What's going on, hockey fans? This is episode 92 of the ClapperCast. I'm Burke, and as always, joined by my co-host, Sean. Sean, what's going on, man? I'm feeling pretty sad over there.
You know, I'm not mad. I'm not sad. I'm just disappointed.
You're at the acceptance stage the grieving process?
I've got the disappointed dad thing going on right now.
Yeah, I'm not mad. I'm just disappointed.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I can relate to that for sure. We'll get into that, I guess.
Yeah, we'll get into that later on in the episode.
Figured we should probably catch up on how the first round has ended up. There's still one series left at the time of recording this. That series will probably might be finished by the time this airs, because that game 6 of Toronto versus Montreal is scheduled for later today. So let's catch up on the other ones, though. It seems like it happened forever ago, but the Colorado Avalanche actually swept the St. Louis Blues.
That was this season?
I know. It was so long ago. And I mean, Ryan O'Reilly had that quote before the series began that, you know, we're gonna beat them. We're going to win, whatever he said. We're going to have fun.
Yeah, that one. That one aged like milk.
Yeah, turns out no. Turns out he does not have the Marc Messier call on his shot skill. You know, it didn't happen for them. Yeah, I mean, it was just kind of over before you knew it even really started, that series.
Yeah, I think this was supposed to be one of the most lopsided series. I think Colorado was the biggest favorite in any of the playoff matchups through the first round, was Colorado taking out St. Louis. And I mean, it wasn't even close, really. Colorado was dominant the whole time. I think St. Louis was able to at least have pressure on, but it's just Colorado was just too good compared to St. Louis this season to even put up much of a fight. It ended up being a pretty lopsided loss overall.
Yeah, just the scoring of the Avalanche just took over. You know, there was, I think at least one game where the Blues took a early lead on a Tarasenko goal. But Avalanche are just, you know, they score in bunches, really, and they just are so, so dominant. So
yeah, the first round, the scoring was 20-7 in favor of Colorado. Like, yeah, that's not even close. The closest they got was losing 6-3 or maybe 5-2. Take your pick. But they're losing by 3+ goals every game. So
yeah, so just really lopsided, and the Avalanche are just so strong. You know, one of the main storylines out of that series was Nazem Kadri doing Nazem Kadri things in playoffs, and earning himself an eight game suspension
that he's appealing. He either appealed yesterday or he's appealing right away. So either way, he's going to sit out for about 4 or 5 games by the time there's even a decision, which is a playoff 4 to 5 games. So that's, you know, 16 games in the regular season, apparently.
I found it interesting that the timing of his appeal came after the Avalanche had won that series in 4 games. Because you think if you were appealing, you'd just appeal it right away. But it makes sense because the Avalanche are now going to, you know, they have less games in the way, so they want to appeal it. But I just thought that was interesting that they, like, the timing of that. And I mean, I think the suspension was big for playoffs, but
it is
Kadri, and he has done this in playoffs before. I mean, he had that one hit. I can't remember who it was on, but he had that really bad hit against the Bruins, right?
He's gotten suspended twice in the playoffs for bad hits like that. I mean, one of them was on DeBrusque, I think it was, along the boards there.
Right, when he was really vulnerable along the boards.
Yeah, he was kind of like bent over, and Kadri like cross-checked him or something in the head. Something along those lines. But there is another one too that I think was an open ice.
Yeah, so I mean, that hit was pretty egregious, you know, like a blind side primary point of contact was the head. I agree with the suspension worthy, but the length seems really high. But I guess that's the repeat offender status comes into play there, and you get a bit of extra penalty added to your sentence, I guess, for that. But otherwise, I think the story out of the that series was just Nathan MacKinnon, like 9 points. I think he had a hat trick in like game two or something like that. Just a dominant player.
Yeah, that whole line, really. I mean, Landeskog had 8 points, Rantanen had 7 points. They're just piling it on every single game.
Yeah, they're just so good. And then Grubauer, you know, played really good. Shout out to Grubauer for absolutely trolling Binnington after the series, because in, I can't remember which game it was, game one or game two, Binnington did his classic skate down the ice and try and intimidate the other goalie, and Grubauer just kind of stood there and was like, what? and then after the series ended, Grubauer posted on his Instagram like memories from round one, and it was just him, like a photo of him staring at Binnington. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah, Grubauer's there just trying to figure out what he's gonna have for dinner after the game, and Binnington's there like trying to get him start shit.
Yeah, so pretty funny. Grubauer has probably got the two funniest photos from this season. You know, the one from the Lake Tahoe game where he's got the sunglasses on under his goalie helmet, and then that one. So I would absolutely love to see the Avalanche go to the finals. You know, I would love to see Grubauer and Burakovsky get another Stanley Cup. And I'm now that the rest of my teams are kind of been knocked out here, I think I'm on the Avalanche bandwagon just because they're so fun to watch.
Yeah, it's just good hockey.
Yeah, I could see people taking a bit of issue with that if they're, you know, anti Kadri fans, but or not Kadri fans, they're really,
yeah, it's hard to punish him. It's hard to punish the whole team for the actions of one player. It's kind of like the whole one kid in class acts up, so the whole class loses recess.
Yeah,
it's like, yeah, Kadri's got to work on his, you know, composure. Maybe I don't know what causes the playoffs to bring out the worst in him in terms of dirty hits, but the rest of the team is fun to watch and, you know, well, yeah, put together. So
yeah, and he's a big part of that team too. Like, you know, as a centerman, you know, line two, line three, wherever he plays, big miss for them to not have him. But obviously, you know, they did okay without him. But I mean, they're for the second round, they're gonna need everybody, all hands on deck. So I guess we'll move on to another team that won in pretty not dominant fashion, but I guess pretty close to dominant fashion, was the New York Islanders over the Pittsburgh Penguins. I was totally wrong on this. I think you nailed this one for your prediction, didn't you? Or did you say Islanders in five?
I think I said six.
We both picked Colorado, but I think neither of us picked a sweep because their only sweep choice was Carolina.
I said Islanders in seven, actually.
So I think, yeah, I went with Penguins in six or seven, and you went with Islanders in seven. So, I mean, we combined, I guess we got it right, because I had the games and you had the team. So both of us combined make a educated guess. So anyway, the Islanders won in six games. You know, they really outscored the Penguins, and I think the Penguins are really wondering if they've made the wrong decisions with their netminders.
You know, as you started this, I'm bringing up some stats here for goalies, and my jaw just hit the floor when I'm looking at the goal saved above average for goalies in the first round, because the worst of all the goalies that have played is Tristan Jarry, -6.27 in one round in six games. The next lowest is Nedeljkovic at -1.84,
who played really well.
Yeah, I mean, how much of that series loss is on Tristan Jarry?
Well, at least one game is for sure.
That one. That was a good play.
So, yeah, what game was that? Game five, I guess?
That would have been five, because that's what gave the Islanders the lead in the series.
Yeah, it was in overtime. Jarry just taped tape to
Josh Bailey.
Bailey, yeah.
See, and the thing, too, he's got... He was like just a couple feet out of his crease. He had a player right along the boards on his side. He had a player on the boards on the other side. The only other player in the zone was Bailey, who was like in the middle, just off to the side near one circle. and he managed to miss both of his players, miss the entire open ice, and send it directly to Bailey in the middle.
Yeah, I think I was watching a game. I'm trying to remember if it was, I'm pretty sure it was that series, but I remember seeing Jari, I'm pretty sure it was Jari, try to make a stretch pass, you know, like that sort of scenario where, oh, the other team's changing, we got a winger up by their blue line, I'm going to stretch it to him as the goalie. And he tried to do that, and his goalie stick broke. And he, like, flubbed the pass, but it went to, like, his defenseman instead. And I was just thinking, sounds like, oh, right. I don't think I've ever seen that happen, where a stick breaks on the goalie on a pass, and then later in the series, he makes this garbage pass. Like, yeah. Oh, maybe you just don't make the passes outside of your zone.
Yeah, he might be one of those goalies that, like, no, that should be told not to touch the puck right now. He's not Mike Smith.
Yeah.
You know, you want to stop it, fine, but, you know, if you're going to pass it, then at least just kind of send it to a defenseman who's, like, 3 feet away from you.
I've got a little bit of Schadenfreude, you know, that sensation where you get pleasure from seeing other people in misery. I'm getting that with the Penguins right now, because that's my saltiness of the Capitals being eliminated. I still take pleasure in seeing the Penguins get eliminated, too. And once the Caps got knocked out, you knew the Penguins weren't going to win the Cup, because every time they've won the Cup, they've had to go through Washington. So it was obviously we're not going to win here, so let's just call it. But, you know, the Penguins have had success in, you know, they had Marc-Andre Fleury. They had Matt Murray coming up. Matt Murray was a young, dynamic goaltender that stole the net from Fleury, and then they let Fleury get chosen in expansion and gave Murray the net, and you know, they won another cup, and then Jari came up, and they're like, oh yeah, let's let's move on to this guy, and kick Murray out of town, and now and now it's like, oh wait, now we don't have another goalie to replace him when he sucks.
So next season, are we gonna see Casey DeSmith take over from Jari now?
I guess.
I think DeSmith was hurt, and that's why they had to roll with Jari the whole time.
Yeah, they only had
to,
like,
imagine those last couple of games they would have had to put into Smith if he was healthy.
I was looking at that and just seeing why they didn't change, and they basically had no option because DeSmith was hurt, and their only other guy was like a third stringer who only made like a couple starts.
Yeah, it was Max Legacy, wasn't it?
AHL or something like this season or something like that. So yeah, anyway, it was a very, very, like, inexperienced goaltender, and so they decided to just ride Jari and see if he could get better. Obviously not. Kudos to the Islanders, too. Like, let's not take anything away from them. You know, they developed a lot of chances, a lot of scoring opportunities, and a lot of odd man rushes, and they seem to be, like, scoring off of the rush a lot.
Yeah, I was just going to say,
in the games that I watched,
they put up a fair amount of goals in the series for the Islanders. You know, 21 goals in those six games is pretty good for that team. That's well over three per game.
And I think Matt Barzal didn't have a single one, right? I think he had, like, very limited points. So they got a lot of
I think
production.
A lot of the offense came from Pageau, Beauvillier, and Brock Nelson.
Yeah, Beauvillier had
even,
a really
even
good
Josh
series.
Bailey had 6 points in six games.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good sign. That's a good sign that they can have offense that isn't going entirely through Barzal.
Yeah, and that's kind of been their story for, like, the season. Like, Barzal, you know, he got scratched sometimes by Trotz. He wasn't, you know, they weren't relying on him for absolutely everything. And, you know, that's a good place to be in when, you don't absolutely need your best player, your most talented skater, I should say, to provide all of your offense. And so they're getting a lot of those. You know, the guys you mentioned, Beauvillier, Nelson, Bailey, they're stepping up and producing, and you know, the Islanders are just scoring by committee almost. They've got such a good roster. And it was interesting to me that Sorokin for the Islanders, but Sorokin absolutely killed it.
Sorokin, I'm glad you mentioned him, because on the flip side of the Penguins getting mediocre goaltending, Ilya Sorokin was outstanding. That he's statistically, you know, top one or top two in the first round of goalies, you know, competing up there with Connor Hellebuck.
Sorokin has been the better goalie, obviously read the hot hand. Trotz has shown that he's not afraid to do that, you know, starting Grubauer in net 2018 for the Capitals. So it's just interesting that, you know, he's not riding the veteran Varlamov. Sorokin was a guy who got a lot of weird games during the season to start the season off, and they started playing a bit more towards the end of the season, and it's just surprising to me that he's the guy right now for them and it's not Varlamov, considering Varlamov had an amazing season too. So just interesting, but yeah, I mean, definitely won the goaltending battle with Tristan Jarry. Yeah, I think the Penguins are gonna probably want to bring somebody else in after that. Like, I have to imagine that we needed a different goalie here.
That should be fairly high on the priority list.
And there's going to be there's a lot of pending UFA goalies that are going to be available. I mean, there's a lot of guys that, you know, might not be super desirable, but, you know, are they going to be an upgrade on Jarry?
Or at least provide a 1B or like another option. Because, I mean, yeah. Jarry was good in the regular season and stuff. He kind of helped get them to where they are. But when he kind of falters, they need a second option. Or they need a third option, I guess, if the second option's injured.
Yeah, definitely. I guess we'll move on to Carolina Hurricanes and the Nashville Predators. Carolina won that series in 6 games, 4-2. We both predicted it to be a sweep for Carolina, and I think we were both probably surprised at the fact that 4 out of those games went to overtime, and the fact that Nashville pushed it to 6 games and could have very easily pushed it to 7.
Yeah, totally. I'm very surprised that Nashville put up that much of a fight. You know, like you said, the last four games of the series all went to overtime, and games 3 and 4 went to double overtime, the 2 that Nashville won. Yeah, that's a long series. That's a close series. And, you know, you gotta give Nashville credit. They held their own against, you know, one of the best teams in the league this season. That's pretty impressive for this team that was, you know, deadline seller time for a rebuild at the trade deadline, to have made that push and then took one of the best teams in the league to 6 games in the first round.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. Bring up a good point that Nashville was predicted to be a seller. There was rumors that they were shopping Philip Forsberg around. It was like, I think there was that list that came out where it was like everybody but Josi, Rene, and Ellis, I think it might have been, was available. So it's like, okay. And so for them to, you know, come out and almost have won this series, this is super impressive. That's definitely a moral victory. I know that their fans and their players won't probably see it like that right away. You know, the wound is still fresh, but I think it was just super impressive that they battled that hard and were able to keep up with Carolina, because Carolina is so good. And you know, if Nashville's power play was better, I think they could have won. You know, I think they only had like a 12% power play or something like that in the series.
Yeah, so imagine if they had been able to get just a couple more goals out of that, you know, bring it up to lead.
Yeah, if they had 20. Just normal production, you know, like a 20% power play or something like that, they could have won. You know. Lots of coulda, woulda, shouldas, but that's super impressive for them to have forced it to 6 games and to make the push for 7 and lose in overtime.
Yeah. I was talking to you about this in a text conversation after the last game, but what was really, really interesting to me is that throughout the series, I mean, the commentators, the crowd, fans were praising UC Saros for his performance in the series, and he was good. Like, he made a lot of big saves. He, you know, he kept the team in it, absolutely. But looking at his numbers, he was actually average, if not below average, in the series in terms of, you know, even his save percentage and goals against average being, you know, about 12, like right mid pack, maybe even kind of below below the midpoint, and you know, goals saved above average is basically zero. Expected goals against was lower than his actual goals against, which was really interesting to me and indicates that it was more kind of the team defense or the defense that, that kind of rallied around and shut Carolina down themselves. And then Saros just kind of was there to fill in the gaps, which was sufficient, don't get me wrong, again. But that just kind of stood out to me as something out of that series.
Yeah, I think it's just like, I didn't watch every single minute of this series, but it might be kind of that like battle between like the eye test and stats, right? And to always have kind of a bit of a healthy skepticism about stats and, you know, not just go full into the stat train.
Exactly. It's a good show of like keeping the balance between them and using one as a supplement for the other.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, but on the other side, we were talking about Jari, like his stats were the worst and he was like the worst. Yeah. So yeah, that corresponds with what the eye test showed, is that this guy's not great right now. And his stats show that. But yeah, I think for Jari, it's like, you know, maybe in the stats thing, you'd be like, well, we would have expected, like the expected stats and everything, it might be, you know, based on his series or his season performance or something. But if you look at like how the teams stack up, you could argue that maybe these should have been skewed to have been even worse against a team like this. And so his, like, I don't know, it's just what the expectations are for him might be why people are like, wow, he's playing really well. Because they had more realistic expectations or something. I don't know. But I mean, I like I said, I didn't watch every single minute of it, but from what I saw, he played okay. Carolina does have, you know, the better offense and better overall team. And so for them to go to overtime in four of the games is impressive. And Carolina does get a lot of shots too. I think they had in the first round, I think it was like average of almost like 40 shots a game or something like that. Either way, I mean, the proof is kind of in the pudding,
over 40
right?
shots per game.
For that, the games to be that close, and for Jari just to be making, or not Jari, Saros to be making the right saves at the right time, you know, that does make a difference for things like momentum. And, you know, those game saver saves don't show up in the stats. It's like, so there could have been a lot of those happening as well, where, you know, he makes a huge clutch timely save that keeps them in the game. And, you know, looking back on the stat line, it's like, yeah, you might have let in three goals, but we were able to score while he made that big save. And, you know, we forced overtime because of that or something like that. So,
Something else to Carolina's credit in this series is that they actually came back from multi-goal deficits in at least two of the games, I believe. I think it was games 5 and 6. They were down by a couple of goals heading into the last half of the third, and both of those games they came back late to tie it and send it to overtime. So that's another indicator of how well Nashville played during the series, is that they were leading into the latter half of the game. They just couldn't close it out. And, you know, Carolina, obviously, you know, they're potent offense, they're always pressuring, came back and tied both of those games, sent it overtime and won.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. I was watching the last game and there was a stat that came up and it said that there's only about like 13 minutes or something in the whole series where there was more than a one goal difference between the two teams. And so it's just like absurd.
And I have to imagine, you know, a lot of that came in the game that Carolina won 3-0.
Yeah, probably. It's just you know, just wild. So yeah, I mean, kudos to the Hurricanes. I mean, they were kind of expected to win here, but they were able to, you know, win it in less than 7. And for the Predators, it's you know, it's still a success because they were able to show that hey, you know, we're still competitive even though we were, you know, counted out by absolutely everybody. And you know, we were considering selling at the deadline, and we made a, you know, we entered in and pushed, you know, one of the best teams in the league to almost do a game 7. And so successful for them. All right, well, I guess move on to the other matchup in that same division, and that was the Tampa Bay Lightning versus the Florida Panthers. I picked Florida in seven, and I don't remember what you picked.
I got the Lightning in seven.
So it ended up being Lightning in six, and I mean, I knew that Florida was a controversial pick when I picked it, but it was more wishful thinking. Yeah, the Lightning just kind of overpowered the Panthers. They were able to get really timely goals, and their power play was absolutely gross. It was 40%.
Oh, my
40%.
God. 40%. That is just insane. Imagine if they didn't get Kucherov and Stamkos back conveniently.
I know. Yeah. I mean, the Panthers was good, too. I think it was, like, it's the second best in the first round, so I can't remember what they were at. But I think, yeah, they were, I think it was, like, 22 or something like that. Because the Tampa power penalty kill was, like, 78, I think, like something like that. It was a really high-scoring series, except for when Vasilevsky shut the gates. And he has been, throughout his career, just, like, dominant in games after a loss in playoffs and in game six after, you know, Spencer Knight came in game five for the Florida Panthers, and the Panthers really rallied around him and they won, I think it was like 5-1 or something. So it looked like they solved Vasilevsky. And then the next game, Vasilevsky just shut the door.
Yeah. 4-0 went to close out the series.
So, yeah, thanks for coming to town. See ya. I mean, what were your kind of thoughts on this this series?
I mean, we kind of thought about this one going into it as kind of the matchup of the first round, I think. It did not disappoint. It had, like, it was, like you said, a high event, high offense, exciting, fun to watch. We saw potentially the start or the escalation of a new rivalry in the NHL. This series got nasty in the middle of it. And, you know, for it being the first time in both the team's history, they played each other in the playoffs. It was a solid introduction, and they're going to be two very competitive teams for years to come. And we're probably not going to see, or this probably wasn't the last we'll see of this rivalry, of this matchup, of the fuel that was put onto the fire for this rivalry.
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree. And for Florida, there was a few games there where it's like, you know, I've never been one of the people to, like, yell at my TV, like, shoot. But I could understand why a lot of people would be doing that watching Florida in this series. Like, they would get the puck, like, in the slot and just look for that extra pass. Like, they were trying to get way too cute with it for some of the games. And, like, Barkov and Huberto were just, they were just so bad for that. Like, they would just not shoot the puck. And it's like, come on. Like, you got one of the best, you got the probably the best goalie in the NHL right there. You got to shoot. get the shots. And then, like, you'd have, like, you know, like the gritty guys would go out there and you can, like, just throw Hornqvist in front of the net and shoot everything at the net, right? Like,
yeah.
That's what you got to do.
One player that really stood out to me for Florida was Mason Marchment. Mm-hmm. He's kind of really blossomed into this high event, high activity player that's you just constantly hear his name when he's on the ice, and it'll be interesting to see how he transitions that into next season, if he's going to bump himself up the lineup with a bit of a, you know, energetic presence on one of the top two lines.
Yeah, he had a really good series.
Yeah, add himself to that rotating cast, kind of with Verhaeghe, and if Duclair sticks around, I don't know how long his contract is, but just someone who can jump up and play wherever.
Yeah, I was kind of thinking in the last game there, because the writing was on the walls, that it would have been really nice for Florida to have had Ekblad for this series, and it's really unfortunate that he was out, because he would have really changed the dynamic of that team, and provided that, you know, potentially, you know, would have made their power play even better, and, you know, being able to play on the penalty kill against, you know, Kucherov, Stamkos, just having that number one D man around would have been huge for them. But in his absence, you know, Mackenzie Weegar played exceptionally well. You know, they had a lot, like, Radko Gudas was hitting everything that moved, making it hard for Florida for Tampa players to get in there, but you know, the level of hockey IQ just isn't the same when those guys have to play more minutes. And you know, you saw Florida's extremely talented offense burn some of those guys. It's interesting as well that Quenneville scratched Yandle because he was god awful in some of those games with really bad giveaways. You know, just terrible.
Did he go and sonk himself?
He was trying to do like a drop pass when they had the extra man and the net was empty and it was to nobody. And I can't remember who it was on Tampa, but they just got it from him and put it in the empty net. And that was it. Game over, right?
Yeah. And then he sat the next couple of games.
And he had another really bad turnover. And so, I mean, with how the season started, you know, it was rumored like, you know, he was going to end his Ironman streak and everything. And then he was just really bad for them throughout the season. And, you know, the fact that he sat in playoffs, I think he came back probably because they had no other option or something. But you got to think he's done there. That turnover was just really bad.
Yeah. One last note for Florida here that I just wanted to send a special congratulations to Sergei Bobrovsky for managing to lose his starting job twice in one season to two different goalies.
Yeah, that's pretty rough. You'd think that
$10 million man.
You'd think that if they could expose him, they would. But they cannot. So I wonder if they're going to try make some sort of deal with Seattle. You know, Florida did that before with Vegas, so I don't know if that's going to work out again. You know, but
that's going to be a hard one to move, like to get rid of a $10 million contract with 6 years left on it or whatever.
Yeah, and like the objectively right move for their franchise is to keep Dreger and Spencer Knight as your guys, and Bobrovsky's nope, going nowhere.
But they're gonna lose Dreger probably, and they're gonna keep Spencer Knight, who's destined to be a starter, but they're not really gonna be able to keep him for without making, you know, their goalie situation just an absolute nightmare with like $16-17 million tied up in two goalies.
Yeah, so they might have to trade away a really good goalie.
Yeah.
In Spencer Knight, just to get something for him so he doesn't just leave, which is would be really sad.
Because the cap's not going up, apparently, for 5 more seasons, so there's not going to be a whole lot of teams that can take on a $10 million Sergei Bobrovsky.
Yeah. Yeah, that's rough. I mean, that's worth noting that I think the Panthers were the only team that has ever started 3 goalies for 2 games each in a series, like, ever.
Not bad.
I think the Capitals had some sort of weird record like that too, this in their playoffs, because they started a bunch of different goalies as well. So, the Panthers started 2 goalies for 2 games, or 3 goalies for 2 games each. It's just bizarro. So the Lightning just looks scary. You know, having Kucherov and Stamkos back is just absurd. So they looked really powerful. That 40% power play is absolutely just like, what? that's absolutely insane. So we'll see if, you know, moving forward, if they can keep that up or if other teams will be able to, you know, shut the gate a bit more. I guess we'll finish off the quote unquote East here with the Boston Bruins versus the Washington Capitals. Boston won this in 5 games, 4-1. We both chose Boston. I chose it to be a few more games than that. I think you chose 6.
I had 6, you had 7, yeah.
Washington came out 1-1 in overtime. You know, had an injury to Vitek Vanacek, won that game without Kuznetsov. And then it was all downhill from there. That's not true, because they were up in game 2 and in game 3, but then they had the lead get away from them because they took stupid penalties, extremely stupid penalties in game 3. Thanks, Nick Dowd. Boston's power play was good. Washington's power play was really bad. I was texting Ryan from Hockey Talk that Blaine Forsythe, the Capitals power play coach, needs to be launched into the sun because he does not change anything. I've been super critical of him since he does that slingshot move and doesn't want to get rid of it. And then now in this power play series, it's like, yeah, let's just keep Ovechkin in one place, even though we've been moving him around all season. Let's just keep him there because it's not working. And then in game five, oh, maybe now we'll switch Carlson and Ovechkin. We'll do it now. So they just weren't dynamic enough. Just, yeah.
And those 5D chess moves led to the Capitals with a 14.3% power play percentage.
It was really bad. They're too good. That power play is too talented to have that low of a percentage. And so that was the major storyline. The power play inequity, just Boston's was good and scored. Washington's was not and was really bad. And in one game, they had like 7 straight power plays or something like that, and then just didn't score at all. And then it's like, you know, there's no, like, you failed. There's nothing to say there. Like, you had every opportunity to take the game over and you didn't. And so you just lost. So goaltending, Rask was good. Capitals had some issues in there, but overall wasn't the main issue. It was just the power play, dumb penalties. Oh, and also the fact that outside of Alexander Ovechkin, Dmitry Orlov, Garnet Hathaway, Nick Dowd, and I guess that's really it. It looked like nobody was really trying. Carl Hagelin, I guess, yeah, because he's on that fourth line. The fourth line, Ovechkin and Orlov, were the only guys that looked like they really gave a shit out there. And I would say that they all had good series. Nick Dowd had that really bad penalty, which was a really selfish penalty to take. But, you know, that fourth line accounted for, like, the majority of the Capitals' goals. So.
Well, who was that fourth line? It was Hathaway, Dowd, and was it Hagelin, you said?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Hathaway and Dowd both had 2 goals each.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everybody else, I mean, Ovechkin had 2, and then Dylan, Oshie, Sherry, and Wilson had 1 each. That's it.
Yeah.
So they were almost half the offense in that series.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, like I said, Dmitry Orlov, there was one game where he was just on fire. I think it was game 2. He looked really good in the whole series. I don't know how many points he ended up getting, but, overall defenseman on the Capitals, like, best overall D-man is still Dmitry Orlov. Carlson had a really lackluster series. Really looked gross out there. Just, I don't know if he's got an injury or what.
Yeah, I was going to say
a lot of the Capitals do, but
what the effect of all the injuries that the Capitals have been dealing with at the end of the season was on this series. Because, I mean, like we talked about going into it, Ovechkin, Oshie, Backstrom, Carlson, to start, I can't remember who else it was, were all missing time or injured heading into the playoffs. And, like, those are all major pieces of the roster that are just, you know, either hurt or not given enough time to fully recover, or, you know, not quite 100%. So
yeah, I think it injuries would be a valid explanation. I haven't really looked into the Capitals, like, press releases since they got eliminated, because I do not want to go there. I think it'd be sad. But if it wouldn't surprise me if a lot of those guys were injured just based off of the overall eye test of the compete level that they had and just the performance on the ice, it just looked like it wasn't there. So it was overall, like, really lackluster and disappointing for the Capitals. But on the flip side, Boston had a really good series. They were, like I said, they lost game 1. They were down and out in game 2 and 3 and battled back and, won in overtime. And, they had their new additions played really well. Taylor Hall played good, got a few goals, garbage goals for them. Brad Marchand, Patrice Bergeron, Pastrnak, obviously, chipping in and performing. It's just so crazy that they have past Bergeron and Marchand as penalty killers. It's just so dangerous to have them out there, and they're just such good forwards, like, at both ends of the ice. They they overall didn't get caught up in the stupid shit, you know, like,
yeah,
Marchand in particular.
Mostly, he's actually kind of changed his tune a bit. He seems to have kind of toned down a lot of that weird stuff for the most part.
I think he has
his moments, but he's kind of turned his game around a bit.
He was still like engaged in that stuff, but he wasn't crossing the line, and he was really riding that line really well.
Crossing, yeah.
And then he got under the skin of like the Capitals' fourth line, who were, you know, really engaged in that series and were the best line overall. But they would take the extra, you know, retaliation or the stupid penalty, and so they got under their skin and were able to do that sort of stuff. So, it was a really good series for Boston, and, you know, kind of not surprised that they ended up winning. I just would have liked to have seen a bit more of a fight from the Capitals, because it was just the overall compete level just didn't look like it was quite there. And with Laviolette there, I would have expected there to be, you know, a bit more fight, and, you know, not go so gently.
Yeah, he was sort of brought in to help give the team a bit more fire, especially in those big games and those matchups like that. But it was pretty tame. They got kind of caught up in the theatrics of the game rather than the actual fight and the game itself.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, kudos to Boston. It was a really, really good series for them. Charlie McAvoy, really good series.
Five assists in six games. Mm-hmm. That was pretty, or five assists in five games, pardon me.
Yeah. So pretty good for him. Or for anybody. Wasn't trying to disparage him there. Okay, well, we'll move on, I guess, to the Vegas Golden Knights beat the Minnesota Wild in seven games. Surprising seven. I wanted the Wild to win so bad. And they almost did, but they lost, you know, one of their top four D-men in, like, the first 2 minutes of Game 7, Jonas Brodin. I think Carson Soucy, I think, might have been injured later in the game as well. And so, you know, they just didn't really have quite the depth to combat a Vegas Golden Knights team that had Max Pacioretty back for Game 7. And, they ended up losing. But really a tighter series than I think most people would have anticipated.
Absolutely. So, the Wild were in this one a lot more than I thought they could be. And it just goes to show that they've kind of got that feisty mentality that can help them compete with the best. You know, they shut out Vegas in two games, you know, that 1-0 overtime win in game one, and then the 3-0 game win in game six. They were down 3-1 in the series, and they fought back to take it to seven games. And, you know, even in game seven, you know, Vegas scored, and then the Wild scored right after. Vegas scored the second goal, the Wild scored right after. And they kept it close until pretty much the latter half of the second into the third period. And then it was just kind of in that last little bit that Vegas really pulled away.
Yeah, I think it just shows that, you know, even though Vegas is kind of like one of the, you know, super teams in the league where they've got a lot of, you know, excellent players, is that, you know, there is still a lot of equity in the team and the teams. Like, there's, you know, there's what's the word I'm looking for here?
Parity.
It's like parity, exactly. Is that, you know, the Wild on paper are a lot worse, but, you know, in a seven game series, or best of seven I should say, you know, the what's on paper doesn't count. You know, there's intangibles, there is all of that sort of stuff, and, you know, that comes into effect. And so, you know, teams can upset. And I think in the NHL, it seems to be a bit more prevalent than in other leagues where, you know, teams will have like a, you know, triple the payroll from other teams. But in hockey, it seems like it's quite a bit closer. And so it's just always fun to see a team push and to fight and to battle, even though they're, you know, a little bit of a mismatch there. And for the Wild, it's kind of like what we were talking about with Nashville. It's a huge, boost for them to just come in and to battle that hard. And I know it sucks for Wilds fans that they, you know, they lost to the Canucks last year in the bubble, and they, They lost to Vegas in round one here, but you know, if you consider how good of a team Vegas is and how they push them to seven games, that really is a victory. And
it's one of those moral victories. That it sucks to have lost in that fashion, but it's like they just took one of the best teams in the league, the team that tied the President's Trophy winner for record for points. They took them to seven games in the first round. And you know, this is a team that's sort of been a bit of a retool rebuild, and they've got a few guys coming up over the next couple seasons that should help them compete even more. Especially as you've got, you know, it seems like Fiala's really broken out as a player. He should be a pretty good player for them in the years forward, and Kaprizov, and Cam Talbot was really good for them this season. They've got a lot of pieces there that should help them be a competitor again very quickly.
Yeah, and it looks like the Wild are kind of moving in the right direction compared to where they've kind of stagnated in the past, where they've been that middle-of-the-pack team. But it looks like if they get, like, you know, a second line center like Nugent Hopkins, they could be in a really good place next season. You know, if they just get that guy, which is, you know, easier said than done, but you know, it looks like they're kind of just like that one piece away from having a really complete team, because their defense is so good. They've got Talbot, they've got Kakinen, they've got, you know, some exciting forward prospects that are going to be joining the team. So yeah, I mean, it's really positive for Minnesota. And you know, it's disappointing. Yeah, the hurt of being knocked out always sucks, but you know, I think everybody pegged them to lose in like five or something like that, maybe to squeak out one win, but you know, to force game seven, and that to win game six so resoundingly too, like that's huge. You know, the players will take that forward for them in their careers. You know what, like, we've been in this situation before, we've been down 3-1, we can still come back and, you know, force game seven, and, you know, we're never out of it. So kudos to the Wild players, and, you know, also kudos to the Vegas Golden Knights. It's interesting that Vancouver took them to seven, and now the Wild took them to seven. So kind of funny that, you know, such a great team has to battle so hard. But you know, that does kind of forge that team as well, right? So you don't want the finals to be the first ever game seven that these guys are playing in. So yeah, good series for them, especially with Max Pacioretty out for so much of the series.
Season he had, having basically a career year, that's a lot of their offense that was hurt. So to get him back for game seven, to get him back, hopefully he's healthy. He took a weird fall into the boards right at the end of the game, at the end of game seven. So we'll wait and see if he's back for the matchup against Colorado.
And then, hate to do this to you, Sean, but, the Winnipeg Jets with the sweep over your Edmonton Oilers.
Yeah. So this is what we were alluding to before, where I'm not mad, I'm just disappointed. And that basically sums it up. It's like, I mean, I can't say I'm not surprised. I can't say I'm really taken aback by this, just because, you know, I fully expected Edmonton to be able to take this series, because, you know, on paper, the roster was so strong. They had such a good finish to the regular season. Everything was looking all right. But then you watch them start to play and you realize that Edmonton still does not have what it takes to play playoff hockey. That their style of play, they focus very much on that counterattack, on waiting for the opponent to make the first move so they can capitalize on mistakes. It's not going to work in the playoffs because Winnipeg shut down. They waited for Edmonton to make the first move, something that Edmonton doesn't do very well, very often. They wait for a giveaway. They wait for a positioning error or something like that. And if Winnipeg just kind of sits back and waits for Edmonton to do something, Edmonton's not going to be able to do anything with it. The defense, Neil Pionk, did an excellent job at shutting down whoever, McDavid or Draisaitl, he was up against. They did amazing with their gap control on those two to give them absolutely nothing to work with. As well as with it being playoff hockey, the whistles are put away. You can get away with a lot more stick infractions and holding and grabbing than you can in the regular season, something that works very much to Edmonton's detriment because of how much they rely on that power play. So you've got the ability to kind of tackle and grab and slow down and interfere with McDavid and Draisaitl on the rush, and it doesn't take much to shut down the rest of the team because there isn't really much there. That being said, this series was also incredibly close because every single game was essentially a one-goal game. Even that 4-1 loss in Game 1 was a 2-1 game that there were two empty net goals. Every other game went to overtime, and Winnipeg, you know, was able just to get that one shot difference, really. So Connor Hellebuyck came in and was probably the best goalie in round one, leading the league in that goal saved above average. I mean, 14.9 expected goals against, gave up 8 goals. You know, he shut the door, the defense in front of him, the team in front of him, their experience, they know how to get through here. They've been in huge playoff matchups before. They shut down, gave Hellebuyck what he needed to make the saves he needed to, and shut down what Edmonton was throwing at them.
Yeah, Hellebuyck, I would agree, with best goalie in round one. You know, best goals against average, best save percentage.
Dude put up a .950 save percentage in round one.
Like, yeah.
says all you need to know, right? Like, it's a goal every like 20 shots, I think.
Yeah, it's I think that's a good point, though, is that it was, you know, people will just look at like, oh yeah, Oilers got swept, but it's like, well, they were in every single game. It's not like they just got shit stomped. It's like they were close games. Every game went to overtime. They had opportunity, but they didn't take it, or they didn't, you know, couldn't capitalize on it. And I think, you know, like there was like after the Oilers went down 2-0, there was like that interview with McDavid or whatever, where he was like, yeah, we're not desperate or something like that. I think it was because kind of his message, like, we're not in desperation mode or something. And then they came out really, really strong in game three. And the Jets just had that huge comeback in the last 8 minutes of the third period. And
I mean, dumb penalty by Archibald, got himself suspended, took a dumb penalty, started the comeback. And, you know, McDavid said Edmonton wasn't in desperation mode. Well, there's Winnipeg in desperation mode at the end of game three to come back and take that game in overtime and put the stranglehold on the series.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of torn on that because it's like, yeah, it's like you don't want to be like sounding alarm bells just down two games, but it's like, well, you know, you got to have the compete. And they did. They came out and really, you know, brought the game to Winnipeg in game three, but then they just couldn't hang on. And once that happened, like once that comeback happened, you kind of just knew that Winnipeg was going to win in overtime.
Yeah.
Like,
oh yeah, it's the only just reasonable mentally
just not there. Yeah. And then in game four, going into overtime, it was really shocking to me that Tippett was really only using, I don't know, what, like 9 skaters, essentially?
Pretty much. Like, he was basically he was literally just rolling McDavid and Draisaitl's lines, the top two forwards, and like Nurse, Barry, and Larson.
Yeah.
Nurse played 60 minutes in that game. He played like 15 minutes in the first overtime period.
Including a like 5-minute shift.
Yeah, a 5-minute shift. And it's just like, yeah, I get it.
Stupid.
You know, you roll your best players, but it is. And by the end of that game, in that third overtime period, Nurse was done. He had nothing left. He could barely skate. His poke checks were him throwing himself and almost falling over.
Yeah, and he got away with a huge penalty too, where he like bear hugged a guy trying to get by him.
He's just like, I just need a break. Just hold on a minute.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, like, yeah, I get that you're trying to like, you know, put your best players out there and win the game, but like you're just tiring them out. And if this is going to be a long battle, which it looked like it was going to be one, they're just going to get tired and they're going to make mistakes. And that's what happened, right? Because
they had a weird change and it gave the Jets an odd man rush.
They had a penalty. They took the penalty, the delay of game. It was Haas, I think, right? Haas took the delay. Anyway, somebody on the Edmonton Oilers took a delay of game and they killed the penalty off. And for that PK, they had Ethan Bear out there with... I'm not sure who his D partner was at the time, but anyway, so they were out there. They give the forwards the puck, and it goes to McDavid on the left boards. he fails to chip the puck in deep, and it gets batted down. And Bear and his D partner go off while the forwards are getting, you know, expected to get the puck deep, like forwards are supposed to do. Again, fucking forwards. I hate that defensemen take the blame for this, but it's not their fault. The D-men go for a change, and then who's coming on? Nurse and Barry, who are slow as shit by this point because they've played, you know, 170 minutes or whatever. And so McDavid fails to get the puck deep, and the Winnipeg Jets just, you know, stretch pass it up to Kyle Connor, who's, like, at the blue line, basically. And the changing defenseman on the long change can't get back in time. It's breakaway scores.
Yeah.
And then you have people blaming Ethan Bear for, like, the one shift he had in overtime. It's like,
He didn't do anything. He went for a change when he was supposed to.
Yeah, he went for a change. They made a breakout. Success. That's where, like, and then they went to change, which, you know, their coach is instructing them, get the hell off because I want Nurse and Barry out there because they're, you know, they're more likely to get a goal. And then, you know, they're too slow because they've been ridden too hard that game. They can't catch up to the guy who also looks really... And Kyle Connor looked really slow on that, too. Like, he wasn't super fast. Like, yeah. It wasn't like Nick Ehlers was, like, flying down the ice. It was like, no, it was like Connor who was also tired and slow, and your defense were just too slow to catch up to him. And he scores. And so it's like, that's kind of in a nutshell, that's why you don't just ride two defensemen, basically, because they're going to get tired and, you know, not be able to be where they need to be. And then it's really sad that, you know, it's still part of hockey, but Ethan Bear was getting some racist comments directed towards him, you know, pointing the blame at him. And again, it's for anyone who's, you know, been around hockey and is not an absolute piece of shit, you know not to do that, and you know that it's not his fault because he didn't, and even if it was his fault, no one deserves that. So
no,
it's really,
like,
really garbage. Don't call yourself a hockey fan if you do that sort of shit. Like,
it's a bunch of racist jerkwads using that as an excuse to be racist.
Yeah, it's like, did you even watch it? Like, how do you get that out of this? Like, at all?
Yeah, exactly. It's like that. It's disgusting behavior. It's exactly what needs to be taken out of hockey culture at all levels. Like, right from minors, like juniors, 8-10 year olds playing, every single level needs that shit taken out of it because it's just disgusting behavior.
Yeah, it's just, I don't understand how you can blame him for that play. I mean, he was involved in, like, the tying goal, where Wheeler scored. I think he had, like, a bit of a turnover or something, but, like, I mean, they had a lot of opportunity to win the game. It's just, you know, it's never one player's fault. And so that's just completely unacceptable. And it's been really good to see how supportive the Edmonton Oilers franchise has been.
The franchise, the players, the league. I mean, even saw the Flames condemning the behavior as well.
Yeah, you know, it's bad when the rival team is, getting involved there.
Yeah, it took a day to get the PR teams all coordinated and get the messages out, but they did eventually. And I mean, every news outlet, I mean, Ethan Bear is an awesome person, and he's embracing the support that he's got, and, you know, following him on social media is, you know, he's sharing all these posts about, other players, you know, condemning the behavior and the stuff that's been directed at him. It sucks to see that it has to happen still.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Like, it doesn't, right? Like, it's just there's always shitheads that are vocal about how much of a ignorant piece of garbage they are, and it's just good to see that the team's and his teammates, like Connor McDavid, had a comment about it and everything, and it's just everyone is behind him, and it's good to see that. So at least there's that. But yeah, I mean, disappointing for the Oilers for sure. I think there is, again, some positive to take out of it that, I think you saw a lot of growth in Connor McDavid in his leadership. in that series. And just, you know, Sportsnet was just going all, like, to town on it. But they were, like, talking about how much more vocal he looked and how he was, like, you know, interacting with, like, the players and, like, giving them shit when they needed to have shit thrown at them. Like, you know, like, I think it was, like, Jesse Puljujärvi or something.
Yeah.
Like, he was vocal with him. And then, like, you know, he's still teammates and his captain. But, like, that's sometimes what's captain's job. It's like, that shit doesn't fly. Like, we're not going to do that. Like, you know, you need to get better.
Yeah.
And so definitely looked like he took a step forward. And then even in, you know, after that game three, he was directly asked about that penalty that Archibald took. And, you know, it would have been really easy to say, yeah, Archibald fucking lost us the game there. Or, you know, like, it was a huge momentum shift and a stupid play. But he didn't say that. He said, like, you know, basically, like, you know, we needed a penalty kill there, and obviously they got the power play goal, and that was a big shift, and, you know, we had opportunity to come to stay in the game or whatever, and, you know, we didn't do that. So it's like, he didn't just throw his teammate under the bus. And so, I'm not saying he would have done that before, but it's like, it looked like he really took a step forward and take that learning opportunity to become a better leader and to take this and grow.
And, you know,
from it.
On that note of, you know, taking it and growing, listening to Ken Holland's year-end press conference a couple days after that, it really sent the message that I think needed to be said, or just like a vote of confidence from him saying that, like, hey, I've been here before. Look at my Detroit teams in the early to mid-90s when we were in the same situation, where you've got this team that's expected to go and do great things, but they just keep disappointing year in, year out. It takes time to build the system that he's trying to build. And, you know, you got to wait for some of these prospects to come up onto the team. You can't just fill and build a roster from free agency and trades. It doesn't work very well like that. You're going to overspend and get players who have been trained elsewhere and aren't going to fit perfectly in. It's preaching patience with, you know, just letting some of these prospects get up into the roster, get their experience, you know, like Puljujärvi and Yamamoto already on the roster, McLeod joining the team at the end of the season, and all the defenders they've got coming up and developing. It's just a matter of waiting for them. And, you know, eventually we saw that Detroit team in the 90s take over once everything came into place. It's just a matter of waiting for the learning, waiting for the right players to come in at the right times, and, you know, everyone to kind of learn and figure out their roles on the team and figure out how to win the playoffs.
Yeah, for sure. You know, it's not, don't need to burn it down just yet.
Yeah, and that's the like, he was getting asked questions, and, like, you could tell the Edmonton media is like, oh, should you have made a big trade at the deadline? Should you have, you know, are you going to make a big trade this offseason? And he's just like, guys, I'm not trading the future for, like, an immediate fit. Like, it's just like, guys, you got to chill. Like, he's been here for two seasons. They've gone from being bottom 10 in the league. Last season, they technically qualified for the playoffs. They finished second in the division. They lost in the play-in round, so they didn't really make the playoffs technically. But they're finishing near the top 10 in the league. They made the playoffs 2 years in a row. Like, come on. This is huge for this team that's been out of the playoffs all but one of the last, like, 12 seasons.
Yeah, for sure. For Winnipeg, Nikolai Ehlers, his return was just so huge for them, I think. Just his shot, his speed, and just what he can contribute was enormous. And getting two goals, including the game winner, and in his first game back was like just storybook.
It's a damn good thing that Paul Maurice didn't bring too much star power back with Dubois and Ehlers in the same game. Gotta let Ehlers shine.
Because they brought Dubois in first.
Yeah.
In the, I don't remember which game it was, game two or something, and then brought Ehlers back when they were both ready at the same time. So it's looks like a big brain move now,
Dave,
I guess.
But Dave Tippett got out coached by that.
Yeah. Crazy. I mean the Jets obviously had a good series, but really close, great goaltending. See if they can keep it going. And then the last series that is still ongoing, Toronto versus Montreal. Toronto has a 3-2 lead, and game six is in Montreal today, and Montreal is looking to force a game seven, and they've got, what is it, 2,500 fans in attendance today?
2,500 fans. For the first time in well over a year fans in a Canadian NHL arena.
So I am 2,500 of them. To that.
It's not 2,500 Habs fans. There's going to be some Leafs fans that have managed to make the trip.
But, of course.
Or they already live there, I guess. I don't know. But yeah, that's, I mean, 2,500 fans in that arena, it's still going to be loud. They're going to be raucous.
I am really looking forward to the anthem. I am expecting it to be goosebumps at that point. So I'm looking forward to that. It's going to be so awesome, and I really hope that it's a good game. And
tune in
that,
for the anthem, turn off the game.
Yeah, it's all I need. All I need. And it would be great for that to go to Game 7 as well. And it would be funny if the Leafs lost in Game 7.
It would be, because it, you know, would they have the 3-1 series lead? Yeah. The storylines would be fantastic off of that.
Yeah, and Montreal fans would forever have that over Leafs fans. Be like, you might have Austin Matthews, you might have Mitch Marner, but you were up 3-1 against us.
Yeah, you know,
Corey Perry,
really...
game-winning goal.
Oh God. Don't do that to me. You know what's really incredible to me about how the Habs are even still in this? They have 0 points, like not even just goals, they have 0 points from any defender in this series. And they have a 0% power play. They have not scored a power play goal in 5 games.
Yeah,
and they're still in this series.
They took that kind of title over from the Leafs. Their regular season power play struggles. Yeah, it's weird. Just if you think about how they succeeded last year against the Penguins, they had so much contributions from their blue line, in Jeff Petrie, in Shea Weber. To have 0 points from them is just so weird. Yeah, but maybe in Game 6 it'll just be, you know, Shea Weber hat trick assisted by Petrie, and for some reason another defenseman. Maybe they'll put Romanov in, maybe, because he hasn't played yet, I don't think. Maybe they'll put him in and he'll get some production for the blue line.
Yeah. I mean, even more. I mean, Weber's hurt. He's got an injured hand, so I can understand if he's not able to shoot. But even Petrie, and I mean, they've got Gustafsson there too. You just have no points from any of them is crazy, or power play goals even. And even more, Carey Price, you know, fairly average in this series too. Especially compared to Jack Campbell.
Although he has made some unreal saves.
Yes. He has, what, that save of the playoffs where he reached back with a stick and took that one down off the out of there. So he's made huge saves when he needs to, but overall, you know, nothing spectacular. So it's just crazy to me that Montreal is still in this series, and it's just a testament to that, I don't know, that forward group they have, the depth, the grit, the battle.
Yeah, they've been getting those greasy goals for sure.
They've been getting a lot of contributions from the bottom, you know, what would probably be like their bottom six. I mean, Joel Armia is leading the team in playoff scoring, 4 points in 5 games. You know, Kotkaniemi, Toffoli, Suzuki, Perry, Staal all have a couple of points, and like that's a lot of bottom six contribution with some of those players.
Yeah, so we'll see. Who takes that series and will face Winnipeg. I don't know who's going to take it, but we'll wait to give kind of a bit of a preview on that one. So we'll move on to just do a quick prediction here for the other three series that have been finalized. So first up is probably, in my mind, the round best series of round two is the Colorado Avalanche versus the Vegas Golden Knights. Sean, who are you taking and why?
I've got Colorado in this game, in this series, just, again, because they are so strong, they're so powerful, and this is going to be, like you said, it's going to be such an amazing matchup where you've got the two teams that had the most points in the regular season facing off. It's kind of one of those Stanley Cup final before the Cup final matchups. I think Colorado takes this, and I want to go 6 games, but I would not be surprised to see it go all the way to 7.
Yeah, I've actually got Colorado in 6 as well. I I just think that their offense is too scary, and they're just better than the Wild, and so I think that they'll take this one. But again, yeah, could very easily go seven. All right. So also we've got the New York Islanders versus the Boston Bruins. For this one, I think it's going to be extremely close. And I'm going to go Islanders in seven on this one. I think that their depth is going to, you know, carry them through. And yeah, I just think that the fans in Nassau Coliseum are just going to, you know, carry them through. And yeah, how about you?
I'm going to go with the Bruins, and I'm going to be, you know, maybe a hot take here and go with the Bruins in five.
Ooh.
That's, I don't know what exactly makes me think it could be a short series, but the way the Bruins had played through the first round, they're getting contributions from both of their top two lines. They're getting production from their defense. And even looking at, like, Tuukka Rask has been really, really solid so far, that I think it's just going to be a strong matchup for Boston to be able to take out the Islanders. It seems like Boston would be a team that could counter what the Islanders can do much better than some other of their potential opposition. And I think Boston takes it in five.
All right. And then last but not least, the Carolina Hurricanes versus the Tampa Bay Lightning. Who you got?
I'm going to go through with Tampa Bay in seven for this one. We saw both of these first round series were longish matchups, and both of these teams are very, very strong. They can kind of counter each other very well, and it's just going to be a real back and forth series that's probably a lot of overtime games again for Carolina. Tampa Bay just with the way their power play is performing, with having, you know, Hart Trophy winners up front, they've got Norris winners on defense, they've got a Vezina winner on the end net. I think they just have too much to go down to Carolina, but I think Carolina's going to put up a fight. So Tampa in seven.
I don't like either of these teams, so this is hard for me. But
you're gonna pick Florida in five.
Yeah, Florida Panthers / Predators. The cat team. I mean, in this natural disaster series of Hurricanes versus Lightning, I mean, what wins in that? What wins in a hurricane versus a thunderstorm?
I mean, is there lightning in hurricanes?
I mean, maybe.
I've never been in a hurricane.
Me neither. They're foreign to me. I think I'm going to go with Tampa Bay in five. I think that they're just too nasty. And I don't think that Carolina's game is going to translate well in matching up with Tampa. I think they kind of split the regular season matchup. But they also didn't have Kucherov. So I really think that addition is just going to be too much for Carolina. And I feel like Tampa Bay's offense is going to chew up Nedeljkovic. That's just my thoughts. So Tampa in five. So quicker series, but it wouldn't really surprise me if it goes to a longer series as well. Just if Carolina puts up more of a fight than I'm anticipating here. I guess that's our predictions, and we'll wait to give a bit of an update for the Canadian matchup. But who do you think is going to win tonight in the Toronto Maple Leafs versus the Habs?
I genuinely am stuck on this because I think Toronto wins the game in a vacuum, but I don't know the effect of the fans coming in for Montreal. I don't know if that's going to have a sway in the game or not, just because it's been so long for some of these guys that if, they get their hometown crowd back with it being like the Montreal crowd, like does that affect performance in the playoffs? Will that affect this game? I'm going to lean Toronto though, just, you know, for all those reasons. I was kind of surprised Montreal is still in this series, that eventually it's kind of, you know, the house of cards is going to tumble down.
I think that the Habs are going to do it for the fans. I really my hopeless romantic was left of my cold heart. I really think that they're going to do it for the fans, because I think it would just be, it's too good of a storyline to not happen. So I think it will. You know, Habs versus Leafs, fans are let back in, Habs win it for the hometown crowd. And then, you know, if they get their heart broken in game seven, that's another story. But, you know, I think that they'll be fired up by the fans, and, you know, not having that canned noise, I think, will make a huge difference for them. And, yeah, I'm really looking forward to the excitement that is that game. And, yeah, I think it, I don't know if they'll win in game seven, but I think they win tonight.
That wraps things up for this time here on Clappercast. Make sure you rate and review this episode and toss a follow or subscribe our way. For more content, you can follow us on Facebook or Instagram at Clappercast Media or on Twitter at Clappercast. Thank you all for tuning in, and we'll be back next week with more hockey talk.